You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another episode of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. I'm once again joined by my friend Sam. Hey, Sam.
Hey there, Matt.
And Alan. Hello, Alan.
Hello.
And we are continuing with our summer series, The Summer of Collaborations. We are actually going to be talking about a collaboration that's very close to my heart. I've been wanting to talk about these people and their collaborations for a while now, but this is now, I think, the perfect context to do so. I am talking about the Coen brothers and some of their frequent collaborators, especially Frances McDormand and Carter Burwell. So before we get into the films that we'll be talking about, perhaps let's just talk about how do we first encounter the Coen brothers, their films, and how do we like them in general? Let's perhaps start with you, Alan. Are you a Coen head?
I definitely called myself a Coen head for a while, to the point of, you know, an upcoming film was an incredibly exciting event. And I think I can trace it back. Actually, it's the Hudsucker Proxy, which is quite an atypical film, but that's the film that I sort of saw and absolutely, absolutely loved. It was the right film for the right moment at that time. It was just its tone, its silliness, its sense of style, its scale. I think it has a beautiful Terry Gilliam sense of scale and set design without some of the problems that comes with Terry Gilliam. So I think I saw that film at exactly the right time and I thought, oh, I like this. And that was, that very much led me into the world of, I need to find out more about these people. I enjoyed it. And then was in that world of, and when their next film comes out, I am definitely going to see it.
So would you say that the Hudsucker Proxy, is it still your favourite film? Or do you have a favourite Coen Brothers film?
Favourite's always hard. I think it has a special place in my heart because of that. I think you would ask me that question on different days, I would come back with a different favourite Coen Brothers film.
That sounds familiar. What about you, Sam? Are you a Coen Brothers fan? Are you a Coen Brothers aficionado?
An opposite history here altogether. My first encounter with the Coens was Fargo in 96-97, wintertime, and I didn't like it. I had a pretty bad time with the movie. And I tried to think of why that was. I think in the context of the mid-late 90s, I was never into all those films with cool dudes, cult movie dialogues, outbreaks of violence. And for me, Fargo seemed to represent that in a weird way. And I remember seeing it. The film melted halfway through the screening, by the way. So they had to place it in again. It felt like kind of very symbolic for that experience that I had a Coen meltdown from the very beginning and I avoided the Coen brothers, actually. Quite contrary to Alan, I avoided them from then on. For me, they were kind of in the vein of Guy Ritchie, Tarantino, Fincher at the time, those movies that everyone thought were cool, including The Big Lebowski that everyone was going on about. And I was more into classic cinema. And for me, the Coens from the beginning were on the wrong track. And so this is really interesting for me to come back to the Coens after avoiding them. I was the man who wasn't there in terms of the Coens.
So in that case, probably there's not much point in asking you right now what your favorite Coen Brothers movie is.
Well, maybe after.
Exactly. I mean, what it definitely makes me think, and I think we will get into this topic later on, is I could imagine that if you are more into classic cinema, that you might have had a very, very different experience if you'd started with a different film. Like, for instance, Miller's Crossing. I could imagine that might have given you a very different first impression. Sadly, we are not going to be talking about Miller's Crossing specifically. We will be talking about other films, but we'll get to that in a minute. With me, I have to admit that my first Coen Brothers experience, it was also Fargo. I loved it, but I am basically incapable of separating out the experience of watching Fargo and the film, because it was the first film that I went to see with the woman who's now my wife. And obviously there's all this, you know, emotional history and I can't disentangle those, basically. I have to say, though, that I think even if it hadn't been like that, even if I hadn't gone to see that film with her, I think I still would have liked it. It was a film, it was a certain style that I had not seen before. You mentioned the kind of cool dude thing, and I know what you mean, but I think in a way it's the other side of it, because with the Finchers, with the Tarantinos, you've got kind of cool dudes with cool dialogue, even if it's subverted in certain ways. But I think the Coens are very much about subverting. They are much more about the awkward, the weird, possibly sometimes the quirky. They are quotable, but I think their quotability is, for me, a very different one from Tarantino's. But, I mean, that's definitely stuff that we'll get into. I have to say, I like the Coens a lot. I probably like the out-and-out comedies less so, and I find the out-and-out comedies sometimes less funny than the films that are perhaps a bit more dramatic. But again, I think that's something that we'll get into. I definitely can see how their films, they have a certain artifice, a certain sustained irony that I can imagine people bouncing off of. I'm pretty sure that we'll get into that as we talk about the films. So continuing from that, perhaps just let's talk a bit about more the general framing here. With the Coens, you sometimes hear the kind of adjective Coen-esque, and obviously such esque adjectives are always a bit problematic. But let's perhaps just start again with Alan. Do you have an idea of what the Coen-esque is for you? Or is it like what you said about documentaries on our last recording together, basically? A Coen-esque film is one done by the Coens.
I mean, that would be a very easy answer. I mean, I think I would go with the Coen-esque, trying to think about what it was that if I saw they had a new film coming out, what would be the reason I'd want to go see it? And I think there would be a sense that watching the film would be fun. Even if it isn't comedy, there would be a sense that there would be something enjoyable about its invention, that it would be, it wouldn't be trying to emotionally move you so much as just engage you with what it was doing. And I think the other quality, I think you would read what the film would be about, but to some extent not have a good idea about how that would play out as a film. That there's an element of unpredictability, that they can say, this is a film in this genre, this is a film that looks like this other film that's quite famous. But even that wouldn't tell you what's going to happen within the film. That would be sort of new experiences. That would be like a plot that, you know, can be very disjointed, but will go in all sorts of interesting directions. So Coen-esque to me means, and it's a bad word to use maybe, but quirky does seem to cover it. There's a quirkiness to the film, but it will be, you'll have fun and it won't be what you'd expect.
Sam, after your first bad experience with Fargo, had you seen any other Coen Brothers movies since, before preparing for this?
I went to see randomly Inside Llewelyn Davis, and I had watched No Country for Old Men because I had read the novel that it's based on. So I came across the Coens without really wanting to, because I happened just to see them. So this is really the first time that I went into the Coens watching out for these Coen-esque elements. And that was quite an interesting perspective to have, because I felt the movie that we watched definitely had connecting qualities. And I would have said before watching those movies, I would have mentioned, you know, again, the oddball characters, the absurd dialogues, the outbursts of violence, the absurd plot lines as well that stuck out to me before. Now I watched it much more in the sense of, you mentioned the word awkward, all these awkward entanglements of main characters, especially the male characters, in absurd plans that seem simple at the beginning, and then they spiral out of control to almost Greek tragedy proportions at times. I would have said also the very subdued use of filmic techniques, and that were very subtle, but very, very noticeable if you go beyond the surface, because the movies kind of look kind of casual at the beginning, at least two of them. And then you see that camera music and symbols are heavily used, objects are heavily used. So I did see a lot of those things coming in that also reminded me of, as I said, classic cinema that I didn't expect to see this time around. And I started really to appreciate also how these three movies connected in different ways and in their use of music and characters as well.
Absolutely. I think that's definitely something that I will want to get at specifically, because, I mean, yes, we've got the Coen brothers and there's a certain discussion to be had there about are they auteurs? But I think with the Coens especially, they are people who collaborate with the same creative minds over and over again. I mentioned Frances McDormand. There's other actors that they've worked with repeatedly, like Steve Buscemi, John Goodman, John Turturro, several others. There's, of course, Carter Burwell, who I think has done most of their scores, if not all of their scores, who has a very specific sound. There's also Roger Deakins in terms of cinematography, and two of the films that we'll be discussing have his cinematography. So I think there's always this question, is the Coen-esque something that's specific to the Coen brothers? Or if not, to what extent was it also developed, created, and also perhaps matured because of their collaborations with these people? Because these are very specific people. I mean, Frances McDormand, she's not Meryl Streep. She's not someone who's that chameleon-esque. She has a range, but she also is always very specifically the same actress. And I think to very good effect. Carter Burwell, I think he also has a range, but he's always very recognizable. And for me, the Coens almost always are recognizable. I have to say that No Country for Old Men is almost one that is the old one out here, because for me that is the one that feels almost the least Coen-esque. Perhaps also because it is an adaptation of someone else's work and someone who has a very strong signature style themselves. For me, the Coens, what they do is very much postmodern pastiche or parody, in the sense that they like using fairly strongly defined genres, styles, whether that's, I don't know, film noir or the screwball comedy. And they do these in a loving way, but they always turn them upside down and give them their own spin. And it's parody not in the sense of Scary Movie or Airplane. It's parody in the sense of it subverts our genre expectations. It uses these genre expectations against themselves to some extent, which I think is what, in a way, Alan, what you said, that we are going to get something that we know intimately, but we're going to see it in a very different light at best. So in that respect, I think their films have a certain artifice in their worlds and characters, almost as much as someone like Wes Anderson does. Although with Wes Anderson, I think the films feel a bit more of one piece, with the Coens, there's a bit more of a range. But let's perhaps dive in. Alan, I think your film is the first one of the ones that we're talking about. Which one is it?
Well, I picked Blood Simple to talk about, which is their debut film. And I have very fond memories of coming to this again in the early days of discovering the Coens. So I was looking out for films of theirs, and I think you sort of quickly discover the sort of variety of what they can do. So if you're coming from the Hudsucker Proxy and then you come to Blood Simple, it is very much not the same, but also the same. You can tell it's the, that there is in that DNA in these two very different pictures. I think you can sense that you're looking at a very, the same talent, that same sense of, I think, love of genre, but also a desire to do things differently within genre. So I think this was very much, you'd hire it on VHS. The VHS was quite worn from the video rental shop, which just added beautifully to this scuzzy quality to the whole affair. And you sort of watched a film that sort of seemed in part sort of slightly film noir, seemed slightly seedy 70s crime drama, that even almost had elements that felt like a horror film on video in how it was shot. And so you had all this stuff sort of mixed together, and I think you could tell that was all deliberately in there, that the Coen brothers are fans of all this stuff and quite deliberately put it in there for people who like films to spot. But at the same time, it was just a really engaging film. The story works. The central performances are incredible. I think that one of the things that really strikes me over and over again with the Coens is, even when you kind of think the film has quite a slight premise, they get really good performances out of people. They really fit the performance to the film and get actors to do something that is sort of perfect for what they're doing here. And I think this film has that over and over again, in the way the characters in this sort of seedy drama of sort of infidelity and people trying to kill people for money and what happens to the money and all this sort of backstabbing and misunderstanding. They're all almost, to some extent, they're sort of like the characters you would expect in such a story, but they're all really engaging. So I think especially Emmett Walsh is an incredible performance, a really strong, charismatic, nasty, sleazy performance. And then I think Frances McDormand, I think, is very interesting in the sort of, you expect a femme fatale in this narrative, and she doesn't easily fit into that, but then maybe she does because the other characters start to define her as that. And I really like what she does about playing someone who is, to some extent is taking all the steps along the road of being a femme fatale, but isn't. And that sort of naivety, well, not even naivety, but that sort of innocence, maybe, she plays incredibly well. And I think it just has this sort of quite unique feeling. It feels like other films in so many respects, but there's no other film like Blood Simple. And that's very Coen-esque to me.
What about you, Sam? I mean, especially since you're not that much of a Coen head, what was it like watching Blood Simple for the first time?
It was very involving from the very beginning. I was amazed to see that was their first film that they did together. It had a very assured style already. And I noticed that with the use of camera that was extremely innovative at times. I'm thinking of the moves of the cameras, for instance, imitating a dog that attacks, or the beginning of the nightly street that looked a little bit like Lost Highway, David Lynch, to begin with. And there were these signatures that were there from the beginning that I felt just were very involving to be in the hands of people who knew what they were doing. And what I didn't expect of the Coens was that would be suspenseful as well. I was more prepared for the absurd, for, again, some kind of plan that goes awfully wrong, which, of course, in this plot does as well. Lots of things that happen that you don't quite understand why they're happening, why people are acting the way they do, why they incriminate themselves so much. And I was also surprised to see Frances McDormand here in a less flashy role, maybe one that doesn't stick out as much as these signature roles that she has had since, including Fargo. And I thought the whole thing was very convincing, including the character of Ray, who's here, the one who incriminates himself by doing all kinds of stupid things, including that terrible killing in the middle of the film. And I thought it was moody, it was brooding, it had an amazing, exciting outbreak of violence at the end, in the finale, where Frances McDormand seems to us as kind of the final girl in the beginning. We think it's going to be that kind of horror movie scene, but then she again flips, and I think that goes with what you said, Alan, about her character. We expect her to be femme fatale, and then she isn't. We expect her to be the final victim, and then she isn't. It played a lot with those expectations as well. So I was very intrigued by Blood Simple.
For me, I have to say, it was a film that I came to right after Fargo. Fargo was my first Coen's movie. This was the second one. And where Fargo, I would say, it almost has like 80% comedic elements, 20% thriller elements. This one is the other way around. There is humor, but it's pitch black. And it is definitely more of a thriller, I think, where, as I said, I would call the other films to some extent postmodern parody. I think here is definitely more pastiche and not that much postmodern in that. It's almost like they set about making the most grindhousey noir film possible. That's almost sleazy, as you said, warped VHS feel to it. And they do that. And if there is anything parodic about it, it's how they boil down the noiriness so much that there's this thick syrup of noir to some extent. And it's also, I mean, I do think it's clearly a proto-Coen Brothers film in that, you know, there's the seeds of what we later see more developed. In some ways, it's almost split down the middle. I think like Ray, played by John Getz, and Abby, played by Frances McDormand, the innocents, so to speak, they are possibly the most normal, according to the genre, and the least Coen-esque. But then you've got the two grotesques, Marty, played by Dan Hedaya, and M. Emmett Walsh's Visser. They are grotesque in how much they fit these archetypes of noir, or, as I said, also an element of grindhouse there. And they're having fun with it, but they're never winking at the audience. It's very, very deadpan, and I think that's something I loved. In some ways, I have to say, the film almost reminded me less of later Coen's films and more of Sam Raimi, in what it does with the camera, with the use of also horror, and again, with the kind of sleaziness. And I think in some ways I could almost, this time watching it, see an alternative route for the Coens, where they would be the ones who would then, 15 years later, make the film A Simple Plan, that in our universe was made by Sam Raimi. There's definitely some shared DNA there, and I find that fascinating. It does feel like a blend of the Raimi style and the Coen style.
It's something I definitely felt watching it just for this, struck by a very similar thought, that it feels like such a successful film. It really is sort of, it works. And you can almost watch it thinking of an alternate universe where the Coen brothers built a career making sort of very recognizable riffs on noir that spun out of this, that they had a real talent for that kind of thing, which probably was, you know, noir and horror. That probably is the route Sam Raimi went down instead of them. but it's also surprising watching this as their first film that you could almost see a career in front of them that they could have taken that they didn't. That, you know, if a studio saw this at first and said, get us the Blood Simple guys to make a film, what they would be wanting is nothing like the sort of films that the Coen brothers were going to go on to make.
I mean, especially if you look at the next couple of ones, which are much more obviously comedies and also kind of screwball style comedies.
And if we have like comparisons to other directors, I thought it was Hitchcockian in at least one aspect, and that's the use of objects, which I noticed in all three films. The focus on, for instance, the incinerator that we see as a potential way of getting rid of bodies, or the fish, the lighter that we see that are so important in the murder scene or the attempted murder. And then later on, of course, the knife in the final scene, or the employees must wash hands sign that is used to such effect. I feel there's such an assured way of placing these objects in the course of the film that then will have some kind of final relevance or added relevance to it. I think that that also made me think it's not just the plot line, it's not just the use of camera, it's not just the acting, it's also how well this works on a visual symbolic level, which shows to what extent there is already an assured style. And that's that what I didn't expect, especially from a first Coen film in that sense.
I think you sometimes have that with certain directors, that their first film is almost the most assured one because it's the most cocky one, where they basically say, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do it really, really, really well. And then it's basically once they've been successful, there's sometimes this doubt that sets in with the second film. You know, how am I going to top what I did before? And I think in their case, topping it basically meant doing something completely different, but maintaining certain elements. The focus on genre, but giving it a twist. I also like what you said. Objects are filled with what seems to be a kind of visual significance, almost a totemic quality, which can be a total red herring because in the end, the fish don't matter. Mm. But we see them several times. At first, they're still barely alive and you see them kind of opening their mouths just about gasping for air. And then they're dead. And then they're more and more basically, you know, going the way that fish do once they're dead. And it's these kind of elements of absurdity that still kind of, I wouldn't say they ground the film, but they kind of make it very tactile.
There's also another factor that starts here and I think is consistent across, you know, the Coen brothers. And it's something I think in William Goldman, the scriptwriter in his book, What Lie Did I Tell? Or I think one of his books, he talks about how The Big Lebowski frustrates him as a Hollywood screenwriter, as someone who knows how to doctor screenplays or improve them, who knows how to write hits. He makes this point that he finds it hard to watch The Big Lebowski because it keeps doing the things that you feel like would be setting something up. It's playing in a sort of recognizable Hollywood, you know, storytelling sphere, but then it doesn't do anything that you'd predict it to. And he cites that when they're in the bowling alley and then there's the Jesus character who says, you know, we're going to smash you in the grand final. And there's this like, is it John Turturro plays this sort of slightly sleazy bowling rival. And there's this big thing about this is their arch rival that they hate and he hates them and he's arrogant. And William Goldman made the point of, oh, wow, this is going to be the end of the film. The end of the film is going to be the big final against this horrible guy because that is how Hollywood works. And of course, this scene just isn't referenced again, pretty much. It sort of exists in its own way, and then the film meanders off in another direction. And I think Blood Simple is already doing that, with focusing you on these objects, making you think, well, if you're watching a standard film, this is going to be important. This is how you normally look at films. And I think that sort of, I do think they sort of like deliberately wrong-footing people. They're so versed in cinema that they kind of know, oh, we could take this route. We could do the obvious, but let's play with the obvious. And I find that really interesting that that's in their first film. And then it's a running theme when you watch what they make.
I was also reminded of a few things that were red herrings to me. For instance, at the beginning, when we hear Visser as the voiceover talking about, you know, what they do in Russia, and he makes those comparisons. And I thought, oh, that's going to be a thing. That's going to be more important later on. Or Marty at one point says, you know, in Greece, we messengers used to be beheaded. So there's that reference to kind of, as I said, Greek tragedy. The being buried alive also has this extra weight, I think, that where you expect kind of something else to happen. I also thought there were a couple of things that they throw in there that are really interesting. But then at the end of the film, I thought, oh, this wasn't really important anymore. But it sets the mood. It gives it some extra dimension. And I thought that's what I meant with the Greek tragedy. In a way, there is something else that's going on a symbolic level, but also with things that are hinted at that are, yeah, meant to give it more weight. But I'm not sure if it's from a screenplay perspective, it really plays out, if it's really exploited until the very end.
Since I said at the beginning, I want to talk about the collaborations. I mean, we've already talked a bit about Frances McDormand and what she brings to this film. And obviously we'll be talking about her a bit more later on. But I was wondering, this is the first time that they worked with Carter Burwell, and I think it's also relatively early in Burwell's career on the whole. Sam, since you basically are Mr. Soundtrack, is Carter Burwell someone that you know relatively well as a composer? And what do you think of his music and the use of his music in this film?
I've recently discovered him a bit more. I knew of him. Obviously, I knew of his connection with the Coen brothers. And then I got this compilation concert work that he did about all of his recent films, including the Coens. Starts with Miller's Crossing, beautiful theme. So I was very curious to see how this plays out. I had remembered Fargo somewhat. There's this lyrical theme that plays over the film every once in a while. And I think what struck me in this film and also in some of the others was how sparse the use of music is. The beginning is just this brooding, moody synth piece that could have been, you know, in those movies, grindhouse movies or horror movies at the time, very standard, not very recognizably Burwell. But then at about, I think, 20 minutes into the film, relatively late, you hear the first Burwell recognizable theme come in, which is always a little bit lyrical, lilting, lullaby-like, and often counterpointed to what's going on in the scene. It doesn't, in a way, accompany the scene that you're seeing or you're expecting. It always speaks at a different level. And again, that I think goes well together with what we discussed before. The music does something else. And I feel particularly with another film that we're going to talk about, that has a beautiful solution at the end where you recognize, oh, where does this theme actually come from? Here I felt it was peppered in every once in a while, relatively rarely. And then there's also source music that is used that I felt was very effective. There's a theme playing, it's kind of Spanish, Latino inspired, that plays over the final scene that we've heard before in that loft where Abby has to fight against Visser and Visser against her. So I thought that was also cleverly used, just the music that they actually should hear in the scene as well. So I guess Burwell also had a say in placing that music in the film, even if it's not his.
And I think one just other thing, which rewatching it now, is that technically speaking, what I bought on Blu-ray says it's the director's cut. And what that seems to amount to is I was sort of thinking, I wonder how different this is, or whether this was what I'd seen originally. And apparently it is shorter than the original release. So the director's cut is, they actually trimmed the sort of end of scenes rather than scenes itself. They sort of trimmed a little bit. And I think, when I've watched it recently, is definitely a case that the film was released, but after its initial release, they couldn't get clearance for a lot of the music that was on it. So I think there were a few versions on VHS that had different music from artists, that the tunes that were playing in the background all happened, that they seemed to fit the mood so much, apparently changed for certain releases because they couldn't get right. And now they're all back in. So if you're watching it now, it is as it was originally. And I think maybe I did see, when I saw it originally, part of that scuzziness. I don't remember the sort of background music having quite the same effectiveness as it has in more recent sort of viewings. Because I think it is one of those weird sort of low-budget films that has sort of an odd history of release and then re-release that couldn't, you know, there were rights issues. And I do think it's interesting that this is, you know, one of the few director's cuts that comes in shorter than the released version.
We're not going to be sticking to the usual chronology that we have in these three film discussions, because I want to basically jump forward to 2001 and The Man Who Wasn't There, basically staying with noir and having something that's perhaps a bit more classically noir on the surface. Also, I think The Man Who Wasn't There is, for me, perhaps one of those films that is the most prototypical and almost stereotypical Coen-esque in what it does, how it does it. And it's one of those films that I like it a lot, but I can absolutely imagine people who have problems with the Coens thinking, I'm not sure this works, because again, they take different genres, different styles, mash them together like you've got 50s sci-fi combined with film noir combined with weird, weird things. And I think it works, but I think I can absolutely imagine some people reacting very differently to it. So The Man Who Wasn't There, I think, is very much this kind of noir pastiche. You even have that in the names. You've got a set of characters called Nerdlinger, which, of course, refers back to Double Indemnity. You've got the visual style that very much looks like exactly that kind of noir. You've got Billy Bob Thornton as Ed Crane, the barber, his wife, Doris Crane, played by Frances McDormand. There's adultery, there's murder, there's dry cleaning. There's references to lots of classic cinema. I mean, I mentioned Double Indemnity, but even to stuff like Lolita, for instance. There's one scene that's almost a direct steal from Lolita, just in a very different context. I think it's really the film where they so clearly, they take a genre, they play that to the hilt, but they skew into weirdness, subverting the genre conventions. There's a constant layer of irony. Again, not the airplane style of irony, but something much more postmodernist in that it basically genre. I mean, all discussions about genre are always about, you know, does this belong in this genre? Does it not belong in this genre? The idea of purity always comes into it. And what the Coens do is they do the opposite of that. Let's mess with purity. Let's basically mix and match in ways that we have fun with. I could imagine them at this point in their career doing a samurai screwball comedy, and they would probably do a fun version of that. There's so much here that doesn't seem to fit, that doesn't go anywhere. You've got Ed Crane, who's the main character, who's basically, he is the man who wasn't there. He's a non-entity. You've got the dry cleaning plot. I mean, dry cleaning in a film about adultery and murder, but it makes sense with them. You've got UFOs coming in again and leaving again. And all that Ed Crane does, he looks up at the sky and he kind of nods like, yeah, of course that would happen. And he goes back in. So it is very much a Coen's movie. It is, I wouldn't say it's their best, but it's their most Coen movie in some ways. I'm not sure, Sam, whether this is one film that you meant when you talked about the role of music. Let's start with the music in this case, because we ended with Carter Burwell just before. What role does the music play for you in how you experience this film?
Well, you mentioned the word classical. So I think what I was surprised at is that actually the front and center are Beethoven's pieces in the film, not Burwell. Burwell's there as well, but he only ticks in at minute 50 this time. I try to listen carefully, and the rest is going together with the exquisite look of the film. And I think the classical music helps this to carry this along. The beautiful black and white photography, the slow move of the film as well. This main character that, as you said, is this non-entity, this man who hardly ever speaks, who lets all the other people speak. But he's very, I think, carried by the classical music that plays along. And then, of course, the classical music gets meaning as soon as he meets this young pianist played by Scarlett Johansson, who we don't know the music is actually by her playing and him listening to her at a party that they meet each other. And then he goes and sees her very often, also a very odd relationship that he has with this young girl. That then also turns into something quite awkward towards the end of the film. So I think the music sounds exquisite to begin with, but then it gets these layers of extra meaning once we know who the music is played by and what kind of character, what kind of relationship that is. And Burwell then comes in. The theme is typical of him. It's not as recognizable as I would call some other themes, but it's Burwell's sound. And it takes over partly, but then is again eclipsed by Beethoven. So I thought it's not the film I was talking about. It's actually the third one where I felt this theme solution was much clearer. Here I felt it was kind of a back and forth, but then it was taken over at the end. And I guess that makes sense with the ending of the film. In a way, Burwell is eclipsed as much as Ed Crane is eclipsed at the end of the film. So that was my reading of the soundtrack.
How about you, Alan? I mean, how does, in this case specifically, the soundtrack work in your experience of the film, but also what about the rest of the film? How do you read that? How do you experience it?
I mean, this, I absolutely agree with you. This is almost the most Coen-y of Coen films. And I think it is the absolute pinnacle of, we are fans of a genre. We are going to wallow in that genre, really make something recognizable. Anyone who likes this genre will sort of recognize what we're doing here. They'll spot the Easter eggs. They'll appreciate that we're capturing stuff visually in the character, in the tone, in the atmosphere. And it's the film that most exists almost just to be that. And I found the music is engaging, but it's just for that reason. It's a music that sort of, it pulls you into the film, but to some extent, on the basis of, look how clever we are with music. This music is going to really suit what we're doing. It's going to pull you into what we're doing. Now admire what we're doing. I think it's quite interesting that this comes after a run of, I think, films where they are doing this, where they are being so focused on slightly subverting genre. So I think you've got Oh Brother, Where Art Thou before this, and The Big Lebowski. And I think all of those have this, they have so much inventiveness within a recognizable cinematic genre. So it is playing, I think, for film fans. And I think this is sort of the pinnacle of that. And I think it's interesting that after this, they sort of do move into more they try and make far more popular Hollywood films. It's kind of like, you can't go further than this film doing this. This is actually, we've reached the point where we've done as much as we can do. Let's now try and do something else. And, you know, they come back with Intolerable Cruelty. So they're very much trying to make quite a mainstream rom-com. It has Coen Brothers touches, but it really is trying to be that kind of thing. And even The Lady Killers, I think they are gunning for more mainstream Hollywood after this film. This film feels like they've scratched the itch of doing this. And I have to admit, I mean, this era is still probably my favourite Coen Brothers era for that sort of sheer inventiveness. But it does feel watching this that I do enjoy this, but you do get a feeling that you can't just keep making this. This is sort of an intellectual exercise that maybe has run its course slightly, and maybe you should try something else. Yeah, because, yeah, you're just going to maybe run the risk of repeating yourself, which is something that they obviously would not want to do. But that, I think, is sort of quite interesting. And I think I remember going to see this in the cinema, being really excited and really enjoying it. I do, and rewatching it, it is a great film. But it's almost a film that feels, this is made so much for me and why I like the Coens that I kind of feel it cannot just, you know, that's quite niche. And I wouldn't expect filmmakers to spend their career catering to this niche.
Yeah, it is peak Coen in some respect. Now, I want to basically move towards Frances McDormand and her role in this film and perhaps give you the starting point from my perspective here. I think The Man Who Wasn't There, even though it plays as noir, it is also very much caricature of noir. I think much more caricature than Blood Simple is. I think the Ed Crane character with his deadpanness, with his wordlessness, but at the same time, he is constantly voiceovering. And we find out late in the film that basically he's got so much voiceover because he's being paid by the word by a journal who publishes his memoirs. So there's a lot of stuff, also the UFO stuff, or there's a scene where basically he does a voiceover. He basically at night goes to the bed of his wife. She's sleeping. He's voiceovering. But then he realizes he has to go and do something else. So he goes and does something else for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, basically the most momentous act in the film almost, comes back and picks up the voiceover again as if nothing had happened. I mean, stuff like that is played for laughs. It's deadpan, but it is played for laughs, for humor. Many of the characters, like the brother-in-law or the lawyer or the friend played by Richard Jenkins, they are cartoony characters. They are one-dimensional characters. They are played for laughs. And at the same time, and I think that's also where Carter Burwell again comes in, he always has this melancholy, almost tragic element to his soundtrack, which could also be read almost as parodic. But I have to say that the film manages to both, for me, it manages to both have that caricature element and then have that central couple, Ed and Doris Crane, Billy Bob Thornton, Frances McDormand, to create a certain emotional sincerity there in some scenes with the two of them. And I think for me, Frances McDormand is key to that. She's got some scenes here that are so subtle and so well made, where she doesn't say a word, it's just played with looks, but she gives this a heart that means that at the same time as the parody, at the same time as the caricature, I feel the tragedy here, the Greek tragedy yet again, the mourning, melancholy element. How is that for the two of you? What about you, Sam?
Mm-hmm. I wanted to say that the Greek tragedy element here again came in for me, and the parodic elements didn't play such a big role here. I was more focused and intrigued by this slow-paced drama, the downward spiral of Ed Crane. Again, a plan that goes bad, a plan that he lay out in order to make sure that, you know, that his wife was cheating on him, that he would get back at the man she cheated with, and then got into this dry cleaning business that got terribly wrong. So he is again surrounded by lots of embezzlers, which I think is a typical Coen element as well. People who cheat each other and embezzle each other. He also goes to this fortune teller later on. And this of course also turns out to be someone who cheats him. So I was more focused on this 1940s, 50s downward spiral of a man who doesn't have much of an identity, it seems, on the outside, who's in that relationship that somehow also goes wrong, and then entangles himself again in this plan that then threatens his wife's life. She takes her life and so on. And at the end, he's, you know, in the ultimate place where you can go in the 1950s in paranoid Cold War United States, he goes to the electric chair. And I felt this was also highly symbolic of somehow a man in that paranoid context of the Cold War and entangling himself with all these things himself. So he's kind of self-responsible. But then by all these pieces that play out at the Coens place here, all the embezzlers and the relationships somehow lead him to this paranoid moment at the end where he has this encounter with the UFO. Again, so archetypically, as you said, of 1950 sci-fi. And then that's it. And even though there's this beautiful shot at the end where he watches the haircuts of the men who watch him on the electric chair, and it's a reference back to the beginning as a barber, in a way it's not, I didn't read it as comedy. I read it as kind of the tragic outcome of this character when everything, in a way, goes wrong. And I think that was very consequentially done here, including the pace, the music, and the seeming comedy, but I didn't read this as comedy at all, strangely enough. And I liked it, I must say. I was quite moved by it as well.
I mean, I think there's something in the melancholy of it. And I do think there is a parallel, I think, with Wes Anderson, in the sense that I think it is quite a measured dose of melancholy that you get when the Coen brothers are in this mood. You're never going to go on a deep dive. They're able to sort of conjure the emotion, but it's sort of quite safely enraptured in a more of an academic exercise, which I think feels very Wes Anderson to me, that you have this sort of quality that they have, that there's something dark happens in the story, and it will shock you a little bit. It'll be sort of an immediate jarring thing, but ultimately I don't think it's the film. It's part of their creation of, we're going to play with these elements, and we are going to have death in this. And even the death in context sounds, that's really tragic, but it doesn't make it a tragic film. It feels like a film that will serve you a little element of melancholy alongside everything else it's doing. And I think that it sort of, again, is quite, I suppose, measured or controlled, the way it approaches this, that it's not gunning for you emotionally. It's not, we're going to break you emotionally over the sadness. But I think where it contrasts a little bit with, I think, Wes Anderson is in those central performances, is they cast people who can then, within this slightly dry setup, can deliver emotionally really well. I think in part because they're not all acting in the same way necessarily. They are given a bit more freedom to capture something, rather than, I think, with Wes Anderson, have a very distinct acting style that's meant to fit in with the style of the film to some extent. But I think that was really, watching this again, it really felt like the mood worked so well, but I do think it's slightly academic in the way they're playing with it.
I like what you're saying about, especially the contrast, the comparison and the contrast here to Wes Anderson. I do think Wes Anderson at times almost uses his actors as props. They're kind of objects. They're kind of Andersonian objects, almost as much as anything else in there. And obviously they bring a certain kind of personal quality to it. But I would still say that, you know, someone who acts in a Wes Anderson film is still very much different from how they act in other films. If you've got, I don't know, Ed Norton in an Anderson film is different from Ed Norton in everything else. But their acting all kind of fits his style, his patterns. Whereas here, I think it feels more collaborative to me. I think to some extent Frances McDormand and Billy Bob Thornton, but especially Frances McDormand, brings qualities to this that I think, I'm sure another actress could have played that part, but I think she very specifically brings something to this. Both the kind of the genre, almost tropes, cliches, but then a more human quality that I think she does very well. Would you say that Frances McDormand also stands out for you in this film, or is she more, basically, does she fit in with everyone else and they all basically do the same kind of job?
I mean, she stood out to me for sure. She maybe stood out least in this film compared to the other two that we watched. But I think it's supposed to be that way, because in a way, the Coens here are talking about the everyday man, the modern man, as his lawyer calls him at one point, of the 1950s, early 1950s. And I feel Frances McDormand is also supposed to look that way. She's not very recognizable as a character. She looks very typically, just like Billy Bob Thornton does, very typically in the style of this citizen of the US of the early 1950s. So I felt she stands then more out with what happens to her character and those small moments that they have, that they share together. I remember one where he, as the barber, also shaves her leg at the you know, in the evening. It's kind of like an almost intimate moment, but is it really? Or of course, when she's in court and she's almost like unmoved in her face by the tragedy that goes on around her, by basically her being accused of a crime. And I felt she does it for very minimal acting. And Billy Bob Thornton, of course, perfectly, his perfect role, I felt, was here, because he's pretty much unmoved, but he has this very chiseled quality of the, you know, handsome man of the 1950s that he could have been at this time as well, a star of that time. And he doesn't do much, but it's effective. And I felt those two were very well set up like that in this film, at least.
I mean, I think she stands out in this film because in a sort of collection of often slightly cartoonish characters, she has some of the emotional weight and she brings it to this film. But I think that's quite deliberate. I think the Coen brothers know when they're going to cast someone to play someone that's completely two-dimensional fun, and then someone where they think, in this film, what you can bring as an actor is what we want to add to this. I do agree it feels like a collaboration, that they allow actors to bring something to their performance that makes more of it. That they're not sort of, it isn't the game of, we have this thing so tightly locked down as precision that you must perform in exactly the style to fit what we're creating. I always think it's quite interesting that they do seem to allow characters to come in. And what they bring to the character, I think, does make them more memorable. I think, you know, across the sort of second string players, not always the leads, they have some, you know, incredibly emotionally moving characters who are, to some extent, cartoons. But I think there's something that someone like John Goodman brings to The Big Lebowski. I mean, his character is a cartoon, but it isn't. There's a humanity there that I think Goodman's able to bring to it, that you see his sadness. You see that he's a man trapped almost by his own temper. And I think that is part of the collaboration that the Coen brothers might, they know they can bring actors in to say, make this work better. You know, this will work if you bring something to it. And I think that's a motive. It goes back to Blood Simple, the excellent casting there. I think that's a quality they have which saves them from being completely lost under the idea that it's all artifice, that they're film nerds making these sort of completely academic exercises. I think that level of collaboration is what helps them avoid that being sort of a valid criticism.
I would definitely agree with that. Since we're talking about collaborations and about the actors in those collaborations, shall we perhaps move on to the third film, Sam's Choice? I mean, I have to admit, footnote, all of these films were chosen by me. They chose which ones.
Peek behind the curtain here about how this is put together.
How we're forced into watching this again.
Exactly.
No. I was, of course, very, very ready and willing to rewatch Fargo based on what I said at the very beginning. How I had seen it, what I had remembered. I pretty much only remembered a lot of snow, a lot of blood, the woodcutter scene at the end, obviously. Frances McDormand is with her very weird accent. I remembered William H. Macy and the two gangsters, kind of the characters, the way they talked. I'm just disliking somewhat how this turned out into what it becomes. And so rewatching it, of course, was a very interesting experience. Here again, I feel we have a man at the center of a very bad plan that he has from the very beginning of having his wife kidnapped. William H. Macy is an unfortunate car salesman who somehow gets himself entangled in bad business and then tries to compensate and somehow blackmail his rich father-in-law by kidnapping or having his own wife kidnapped. So we see him with these two gangsters at the beginning, played by Steve Buscemi and Peter Stormare. And these two meet him at the beginning in a bar, and they set up the plan. We know from the beginning that this is probably not going to go well based on the dynamic between the three of them, between the two gangsters. And of course, this kidnap plan spirals out of control, again, in a very tragic way for the wife, but then increasingly also for everyone involved. So William H. Macy gets himself entangled in more and more absurd acts of trying to make up for the plan that his wife does get kidnapped, even though he doesn't want her to anymore. His father-in-law gets involved in the plan and then, of course, gets himself killed. The two gangsters get into more and more conflicts as they have this wife out at a lodge by a lake And then, of course, there's the entrance of Frances McDormand as a policewoman, as a pregnant policewoman. And she has her very own ways of investigating this case. And yeah, finally successfully comes across, maybe by coincidence comes across, this bad laid plan. And then, of course, with the gory outcome that it has. So that's, I guess, the basic setup that we have here. Frances McDormand plays a very, very iconic role here, an Oscar-winning role that kind of put her on the map for so many other films, also outside the world of Coen. And I also felt, in terms of collaborations, Burwell also wrote a very recognizable Fargo theme here. So I will also begin with that question concerning music. What stood out for you in terms of the use of music here? Because I felt, for me, this was the most iconic film of the three in terms of so many different things, but music played a big role as well.
I mean, I think musically this feels very much like the Coen brothers doing a very sort of, they're making quite a Hollywood film with the music. The music is doing what you would want a sort of Hollywood film score to do. It is both beautiful at times, but then it also captures a mood. It plays tense. It underscores so much of it with all these different emotions that you almost want from a cinema score. I think it's most reminds me of Miller's Crossing on that score, that you have the music is, it is very strong musically on its own, but it also fits the film perfectly. It does what you would, what film scores need to do in the most sort of traditional sense. And I think it's really good. It hooks you. It still is recognizable. If you hear it completely out of context, it makes you think Fargo. It does have this sort of immediate association with the film. It sort of shows that they can, and Carter Burwell can do scores in this way. And that's, I sort of really enjoy that and find that admirable, that you know, they will go, we will do this very sort of, what are scores meant to be in a big film? That is what they're meant to be, and it fits that perfectly.
Did music have the same impact on you in this film, Matt?
Half yes, half no. I think, to me, again, the music here is one of counterpoint to some extent, because the crime story that we're watching is basically, it's small-time crime. It's also, it's grimy. It's something that becomes tragic, but basically it's idiots doing idiot things. It's not about, you know, multi-million deals. It's not about that kind of thing. It's basically idiots being idiots because they're greedy and stupid and don't know how to get out of trouble. I was wondering, you know, is this also, again, a genre pastiche or parody? And if it is, I think it's very much this true crime based on a true story thriller. And it's one that, it plays the mundane to the hilt. These are people in ugly rooms with ugly wallpaper wearing ugly clothes. And the music, what it does, it gives it a certain gravitas, a certain almost mythical grandeur. But also, again, I think Burwell always has this underlying melancholy that's in there. So does it elevate the kind of everyday banal crime story, or does it kind of counterpoint it parodically, making it even more seedy than it is? Kind of both for me, I have to say. There is this kind of, again, deadpan, you know, we're making fun of what we're showing here, but we're also turning it into something else than it is. Because again, I find that this is a film that very much has a comedic strand to it, but in parts it is very effectively tragic to me, and that's where the music kind of, again, helps give it that tragic undertone for me.
Very well described. I would have also called it kind of ambiguous here, the use of music. I called it mythical. I wrote down kind of medieval tale music. And then at one point it turns into this lullaby. And I think that the solution to the theme for me was what I mentioned earlier, was that for me it was finally associated to Frances McDormand's kid. You know, the kid, the lullaby, the family, the unit that exists in the film that only comes out through maybe halfway through the film, where that becomes an actual thing. And then towards the end, it becomes kind of the nucleus of the film somewhat, that now everything is over. And now the three of them, including her fantastic husband, Norm, can focus on becoming a family. And I felt it somehow resolves itself in that. But before it, it plays counterpoint. I also noticed that a lot, that we have this tragedy accompanied by this kind of medieval mythical theme that gives it kind of an epic build at times, also with the police coming in, or with the snow landscape, obviously, that we have so present in this film. So I felt it really gave it, we called it gravitas, it gave it weight. And I think it, again, like in all the Coen films, added another layer where I felt it's not just the grimy, bad laid plan that plays out here. It's not just about these stupid, silly people getting themselves entangled in all kinds of different ways. It's about more than that. It's a portrait of that place and those people and that background, also the Nordic background of North Dakota, where that plays out. So in a way, I felt that was very also deeply rooted in some things and gave it some extra layers here. Obviously, one key character that we've also already mentioned is Frances McDormand's police lady here, March Gunderson, as she's called in the film. Let's maybe continue with her, because she comes in relatively late in the film. Obviously, a lot of the bad light plan has already played out, and then she steps in. And I think, it's completely changed the film around into a different direction. What kind of role did she play for you here? How does Frances McDormand make this film what it is? Because I feel she's so central also to the reputation of the film. So what is it that makes that, and is that in any way comparable to the other two films that we've talked about?
I mean, I think what she brought, I mean, she's just incredibly charming. It's you can see why she won an Oscar. It's like you like this character very quickly after he appears. And I think you care for her quite quickly. And I think one of the things that Fargo does, which works really well, is it presents that this slightly sort of scuzzy world, there is horrible violence here. There is a darkness here that when she's introduced, when you first see the film, you kind of think, well, it's the Coen brothers. She's not necessarily safe. I think there's a feeling that sort of like the more you get to like her, the more it feels horrible that, like, not Marge. Like, nothing bad can happen to her. Because you're all these characters in the slightly sort of seedy world of a noir plot, a very sort of low-level, cheap, slightly pathetic noir plot, in the sense that of the characters involved in it. But then you have this character that is so likable that you really care for her. You really care for the future that she could have. It sort of lays this on. And certainly the first time I saw it, there was this experience of thinking, this is the Coen brothers. She's not safe. And I wonder if that was, to some extent, what they were going for. And then again, Frances McDormand is so good at acting that she brings so much extra humanity to sort of, this is the nice person that, you know, might be in trouble. Sort of a bit like the character she plays in Blood Simple, to some extent. But then she adds all these layers. It's almost like a sort of post-Twin Peaks quirkiness to it. But then just make you like her. That she is a good person. And she's not judgmental, but she's practical. And I really like this person. And I do remember watching it the first time, just thinking, oh my God, if something happens to her, this is terrible. And the bit where she's heading to where the gangsters are was properly like, oh my God, because it is absolutely within the wheelhouse of the Coen brothers that she doesn't make it out this film. And I think the feel-good sense of relief then adds to subsequent watchings. You can watch this film over and over again because you kind of know it sort of delivers on sort of a happy ending. But I think her performance is that. It is just to make you really care for her, really like her, and sort of buy into her as being just basically good so that you don't want anything to happen to her.
I love that, Alan, that you mentioned Twin Peaks, because I now absolutely want a series that has Marge Gunderson and Special Agent Dale Cooper travel the US and solving crime together. I would totally watch that.
I'd be worried, though. What if Marge Gunderson gets trapped in the Black Lodge and there's the evil duplicate Marge Gunderson that spent 20 years out in the wild being evil?
That would be her character from Three Billboards, I think.
Yeah.
I love that Marge Gunderson, that Frances McDormand, to some extent. She's the shark in Jaws in that film, you know, in this film, in how basically it takes such a long time for her to turn up, but then obviously I would totally agree she's the heart and soul of the film, which makes it sound treacly and saccharine, and it isn't. I think Marge is the reason why I don't quite agree with people who said, you know, there's people who criticize the film for looking down on its Minnesota characters, you know, with their silly accents and their silly clothes and their silly, it's basically all of it is kind of banal and trite and boring, and that's what it was accused of. And I think the thing is that Marge is of a piece with the world she lives in. But she is sweet and lovely, and she's also savvy. Mm. She never looks down on any of these characters. Even if we chuckle at them and their funny yars and whatever, she doesn't. and we root for her. So I think it also makes it more difficult for us to look down at the world around her. She, in a way, by being so human, so warm, adds a certain humanity to characters that otherwise perhaps would not have that. And I think, for me, it's really her, together with William H. Macy, Jerry Lundgaard, who are key to making this film more than just funny, but kind of an exercise in genre pastiche. She's got the kind of sweetness and humanities, but he's also, in his pitifulness, he also is both cartoony. I mean, look at his face. There's almost a Looney Tunes quality to how he contorts his face. But he is so deeply human in how much of a loser he is. And he's basically to blame for everything, but he still remains pitiful in every sense of the word. And I think both of them kind of ground this film in ways that I really, really love.
I would add that Steve Buscemi also has some of that quality, I must say, by having himself hurt and destroyed so much by the end of the film, literally. I also rooted for him for a while because he's so well counterpointed with his gangster pal, who is the truly evil one. I also felt that sense of pity for Steve Buscemi, even though he is that horrible gangster, of course. But yeah, it does ring very true to hear that about the Marge character. I also thought she was so central to why I cared about this film, or started to care about it much more. Because William H. Macy, of course, he's silly. He entangles himself in the absurd. He also makes so many mistakes, a little bit like Ray in Blood Simple. You don't want him to make all these mistakes, and at the same time you marvel at how stupid someone can be, at how uncaring he can be towards his wife and towards his son especially. So there's also these terrible family scenes. But yeah, it's true. March makes us care for her family as well, obviously for her child. You know, to put a pregnant policewoman at the center of all this is such a clever plot element that, of course, we have this extra special care for her. And also how she treats people so respectfully. I think even when she has that awkward interview, that second or third interview with William H. Macy about the missing car, and it's so obvious that he is lying, she still treats him with a certain amount of respect, but also shows him that he's gone far enough in his obvious lie. And I think there's also power, a kind of a shift in power, where she is clearly in control and he can do nothing than just sneak away and leave and just drive off. So she also is very assertive in her investigation, even at the end in her final confrontation. There was a bit of a Jodie Foster moment, I think, at the end, you know, Silence of the Lambs, where you felt so much for that the main character at risk, and she's facing this terrible danger, and will she make it, will she not, and she succeeds. I think that was a standout moment. Maybe talk a bit more generally about Fargo. We talked about music, main characters, the setting already a little bit, and of course, if we talk about the Coen-esque, is there anything else that makes this film particularly archetypical? It's certainly among the most famous ones, the most iconic ones. And I think when people talk about the Coens, they very often talk about Fargo. There's also a TV series that has played over several seasons called Fargo that I haven't seen, but maybe you have some experience with. So what makes Fargo stand out among the works of the Coen brothers?
I think for me, it's definitely that of the films that I've seen, I think it's the most perfectly constructed one. I think they always have their tangents, and the tangents are also great, but here, in a way, everything adds up to the whole. Even scenes where at first I thought, I'm not quite sure why they're here in the film, like the one with Mike Yamagita, that school friend that Marge meets. I've come to understand it actually has a function in the film, it has a function in the character arcs. I think, again, for me, it's how it manages to be both kind of funny, caricaturey, parodic, quirky, but still have a certain emotional through line, a certain sincerity. To be ironic and sincere at the same time. I think that's what the Coens, at their best, they manage that. They don't always manage it, but they manage it here for me. I think the other thing is also, I mentioned Roger Deakins, I think briefly earlier on. He's kind of the absent collaborator because he's only worked on two of those films, but he's worked a lot with them. And for me, he helps the Coens so well to get both of these sides. You know, the banal, boring, tacky, tasteless Minnesota style. I mean, he's got scenes that are not ones that you want to hang on the wall. These offices, the interior decoration, it's kind of awful, and he plays that to the hilt. And then he's got other scenes where he especially uses the whiteness of the snow. There's this one where the camera is almost looking from above down at the parking lot, where you've got the cars and you've got Jerry Lundgaard, William H. Macy, walking towards his car. And it's basically the kind of frame that you want to frame and hang on your wall. But it's used to effect. It's not just, oh, look here, you know, fantastic cinematography, you know, enjoy this. It's not masturbatory. It's still, like the music, it gives it this certain kind of gravitas, this certain kind of grandeur that counterpoints the caricature elements.
I mean, I definitely, in terms of it being Coen-esque, it has that quality that you can be thinking it's going to do something, and actually it doesn't seem interested in that. And one thing that has lasted a long time with me after this film, which is an emotional reaction you don't expect with the Coens, and it's to some extent the fact you don't see the wife getting killed. So part of the whole thing that it goes wrong is it's a fake kidnap. So they're just meant to kidnap her, then they'll get the money, they'll let her go, and then they'll split the money, including with her husband. And then at some point, one of the gangsters who you realise is a loose cannon, he's left alone with her, and the next thing you know, he's killed her. And that is such a dark moment that isn't shown. It's almost throwaway. It's almost quite casual that one of the characters comes back and goes, oh, what happened to her? And she's just, there's just a corpse in the corner of the room, almost, still with the bag over the head. And it's such a dark moment. And I think it's interesting that they don't show it. I think, again, that you would almost, people who were telling this film conventionally, that would be the heart of the film. That would be the thing where the kidnapping has gone from bungling to a proper human tragedy. And it's not shown. And I always, I think, has always sort of, that's left with me in a way afterwards. And on a similar vein, their son, at the sort of end of the film, you realize that if this is the reality, their son, he's got a horrible time. He's lost his mum, he's lost his grandfather, his dad's going to prison, he's lost everything, and he's completely innocent. And again, the film isn't interested in that. It's background. It's not what they want to tell us about, even though I feel as someone who's, you know, watched so many films, I'm almost primed to think, well, what's that story? Surely that's what this is about. The boy earlier is such a sort of credibly realistic, slightly annoying kid but he doesn't deserve this. He doesn't deserve where he is at the end of it. And I think that, again, is the reason probably I hesitated with the word quirky, is that it can be pejorative. It can be someone doing something odd for the sake of something odd. But I think the best Coen brothers, they're doing what you don't expect, and then it lands. The reason it's different actually will resonate with you, and you suddenly think, well, not doing that suddenly has a power in itself. So it is sort of quirky in a way, but I think there's some real sort of cinematic quality in that I really sort of enjoy in their films.
And that brings me back, I think, to my initial image that I had of the Coens. I did think they were doing it for effect. I did think the violence and the outbursts and the dark moments were really just done to be, as I said at the beginning, cool duty. And now rewatching, especially Fargo, I felt, oh no, this is built up properly. They leave certain strands open. They don't show certain things. They focus on, I called it the nucleus before, for instance, of that March and her family, or the bad late plan. But I think it had this extra layer of meaning, of gravitas, of this was about the proper portrait of that moment in time, this true story and how it played out and where it went, without showing everything, without bringing everything to a close. But it did feel it was the most memorable of the films that we watched for this podcast, the one that I'll probably also watch again, because I want to get back into that portrait of North Dakota 1987, Brain Ward with the Bunyan statue and so on. It had so many iconic moments. And I'm even interested in seeing the Fargo TV show at one point to see what it's like, because I felt there was a lot of potential for characters in that place, including March, of course, but also many of the other characters that we see just briefly, to see where that goes, what kind of place this could be in future scenes. So I can see why that is the most memorable, maybe iconic, of the Coens among the ones that we've seen.
I have to say, I've seen the first season of the Fargo series, and I think it's very well crafted. It's got good actors, it's well shot and everything, but it didn't work for me at all, because it felt like a remix of the quirks of the film without understanding the heart of the film. It all felt like it, in a way, to me, the series felt like what some people accuse the Coen brothers of being, empty postmodernist pastiche. I know others who actually liked the series better than the film, but for me, it didn't work at all. So I'd definitely be curious to hear what you think, Sam. Have you seen it, Alan?
Again, like you, I've seen the first series, and I think it's, I mean, I always find it quite interesting because there was always talk after the film, this was one of their commercial successes. And I think after this had been successful, there was always talk of the continuing adventures of Marge Gunderson as a TV show. And it never quite got off the ground. So I think there's an element when you come to the sort of Fargo TV series that it's going for the tone more than anything, I think. And yeah, it doesn't quite capture the tone of the film. It's too obviously these are the elements of this type of storytelling. Without, I think, some of the depth. So I did sort of enjoy it in terms of sort of binge watching TV. I think it's definitely the first one, but I've only seen the first one because I didn't dislike it, but there's a lot to watch on TV these days and making that, you know, you sort of think, oh, I'll get round to it one day. But I think it's sort of quite interesting that they, and it's sort of meant to be a bit of the future series. It's a bit anthology that they don't continue telling stories. Each season is meant to be sort of its own story within this sort of mood, this type of story. It's kind of playing in this location, and rather than like, I mean, one thing that she does, Marge Gunderson, reminds me a little bit when I was rewatching it, is she's got quite the Columbo part in this, in the sense that there's so much before she turns up. She's the detective that turns up after we've seen so much story of the murder, of the tragedy. And I think you could have built a series around that. It's like weekly, you know, decades before Poker Face got made, you could have had this like weekly show where she turns up as Columbo and the sort of solves it. But yeah, I would be interested what you think about it. It's an interesting endeavor. And I think it deserves something that, yes, I think it fails in some respects, but as spin-offs from a film goes, there is a bit more invention than in some others.
I might check out a few episodes in the future, but I think this podcast also made me want to check out more Coen, obviously, after seeing those three. So maybe as we go on from here, would you say there are other Coens that you would recommend me to watch as a second next movie? What else do we need to see in order to understand the Coens, or is that the nucleus that we watch now?
Well, I think this is where I revealed that this is not actually a podcast recording, but it's an intervention. We knew that you don't like the Coens, Sam, so we basically staged this intervention to get you into them. And I get the impression that we've probably kind of succeeded. But if we keep pretending that this is a podcast recording, and I would say that, I mean, this was my choice of also, to some extent, favorite Coen Brothers films, and I left out the more clearly comedic ones because that is not so much my style, but that's a personal thing. I could imagine that, especially with what Alan said about the Hudsucker Proxy, that there's some there, Hudsucker Proxy, perhaps also, what is it called? Arizona?
Oh, yeah. Raising Arizona?
Raising Arizona, that's it, yeah.
I think I really like them as their comedy. I think they're out-and-out comedy. I think stretching back to Hudsucker Proxy. I think there is something when they're just out and out having fun and to some extent willing to embrace silliness. And I think I have a huge soft spot for Hudsucker Proxy, but I really enjoy Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? I think that is a film I do rewatch. I think that is to some extent them making a comedy for fans of classic film in the sense that it is just a collection of idiots, but it's beautifully shot. It's one of the first films that really made me aware of what they could do with like digital grading and how they can give something color and sepia tint. It looks incredibly gorgeous. And it just has this fun plot of these three idiots traveling this sort of period America setting that, like, I can see why some people wouldn't like it. I can see why it seems sort of such a sort of exercise in academic silliness, but it absolutely hits the spot for me, especially coming from, I think, you know, really liking screwball comedies. This is the Coen brothers saying, we like the same screwball comedies that you do. Now let us show you what we could do in our slightly ironic way of playing with it. But I think that That is a film that has beautiful music to it. It's got such a strong, inventive visual style. And I think, again, the performances are playing that on paper, they're clowns, they're two-dimensional, but they do manage to bring a humanity to it. They do sort of, you start caring about them, or you start not caring about them. You just sort of enjoy watching them have screwball violence enacted on them. It has this sort of quality that it is probably the most out-and-out, silly Coen Brothers. And I absolutely adore it. And I went to see it in the cinema. I think that was, again, I think it's been tainted because that was a really nice trip to the cinema. It was like a preview, I think, they had. So I was seeing it first, and it was a packed cinema, and it was a very exciting event. So that ties in with it as well. I would sort of recommend that if you want to see a side of the Coen brothers that these three films don't really touch upon. I would watch Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? And if you enjoy that, then I'd watch The Hudsucker Proxy.
Perfect. I've put them both on my list as you were speaking already, because I feel I want to expand my palette of the Coen brothers. And if this was an intervention to get me into the Coen brothers, a job well done succeeded. Now I'm really curious. And I did like all three films. So thanks for taking me there.
Very good. I would even say that, especially at this point, it might be worth for you to revisit The Big Lebowski. I think The Big Lebowski is kind of harmed a bit by, like Fight Club, having some of the worst fans. It's the kind of film that boring people will quote at you at great length until you hit them over the head. So just as soon as they start, hit them over the head. It saves everyone time. It is a film that when I first watched it, I didn't like it, but I thought there was something there. And since then, I've seen it about 4 or 5 more times. And every time I watch it, I actually like it better. Because again, I think you've got these kind of three central idiots, caricatures, but thanks to the actors, Steve Buscemi, John Goodman, and Jeff Bridges, give them a certain humanity. I think it also is one of the most inventive, stylistically, formally inventive films that they have. And even if you might end up not liking the thing as a whole, there are sequences that I think are amongst their best sequences just for sheer craziness and fun. I mean, there's this musical sequence in a bowling alley with Vikings, and it's all basically Busby Berkeley. And it just is so much fun once you no longer go in expecting this or that or the other. I think the Coen brothers can suffer from, if you go at any of their films expecting a certain specific thing. Miller's Crossing, obviously also one that you absolutely have to watch just because it's so gorgeously made. And if you're into classic cinema, I think you will like it.
And I think one thing, I definitely echo the Big Lebowski and the musical number. And I think there is a sort of idea that someone tells you, oh, there's this Busby Berkeley inspired bit in this film. And whenever you watch it, I always find it underwhelming. And this is the only time even a relatively modern film has done a Busby Berkeley-inspired sequence that I think stands up, that has that level of just invention and fun, like visual fun with it. And I think that's, you realise that that can be an end in itself. It sounds quite dry, and people who rip off Busby Berkeley other times, it just, why are you doing this? It's not as good. If you do it with this much fun and this much inventiveness, it's an end in itself. It's justified. It is worth doing. I would definitely echo that recommendation of The Big Lebowski.
I think even in their worst films, there's always been bits that I liked. But there's definitely such a thing as lesser Coens. And I would agree with you, Alan, that probably after Fargo and The Big Lebowski and Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, they kind of had a phase where it all felt a bit like copies of the Coens. People trying to do the Coen thing but not quite succeeding, which is kind of a shame. But yeah, before basically we really get into, oh, and this film is great for that, and that film is great for this, let's perhaps try to bring this to an end. As I said, I wanted to talk about the Coen-esque, but also what collaboration brings to this. So based on the films that we've seen now, what is your impression? To what extent are the Coens very much the driving force behind this, and to what extent is it the collaborators that they seek out? We talked about Wes Anderson. I think, as I said, with Wes Anderson, there's an element where the actor's almost replaceable. If you've seen the trailer for, what is it called, Asteroid City, where you've got Tom Hanks and you see, it's Tom Hanks doing the Bill Murray in a Wes Anderson films bit, where it really feels like it doesn't matter. It could have been Bill Murray. It can be Tom Hanks. It doesn't matter because it's Wes Anderson using these people as props. How do you feel about this with the Coens now?
I mean, definitely, I think the collaborators add something to the film. The actors do bring a humanity to what could be cartoonish characters, as we sort of mentioned before. And I think Carter Burwell has a good understanding of how to write music that sticks in the memory, that is evocative. And I think they really bring that to the table, and they add to all the films. I mean, you sort of have to ask the question, well, obviously it's a collaboration, but, you know, the Coen brothers are probably bringing them on to do that. You know, they know they have these talents. They give them the freedom to make these talents. And as a package, it works really well. But I think when they get really good performances from, they cast incredibly well across the board. I think, you know, they get people in who you don't expect to play a character, and it works. It is something that, you know, they manage to do. There's a real strength of this.
What about you, Sam?
Well, it's hard for me to say, based on these three films, how much they interact with these collaborators, how much freedom they have in choosing the style of music, for instance, or work on their characters, how much the Coen brothers are giving guidelines of how that should sound or of how that should look like, what the character should be, how much is written on the page. So I don't have the making of that, but just based on the films that I've seen, definitely stand out actors and actresses, characters that they imbue with so much life. Frances McDormand obviously is in all three films, and she stands out in all of them, particularly in Fargo, but also she's very memorable in all of her roles. She is also a type of female character that I don't think I've seen in many other films. Also unique in that sense, in their context, in the way they act, in their, we say in German, Handlungsspielraum, so the space they have to act, which is bigger or different from genre films like these. I mentioned The Final Girl here, and she does a twist on that, or The Femme Fatale that Al mentioned at the beginning. So definitely very, very stand out. With Carter Burwell, I was more surprised that he's so subdued, that his use of music is so subtle in many cases, with few exceptions, and that's so sparse in the films. I'd have to see more Coen films. I know some of his soundtracks from listening to them, but I would have to see more of how he uses music in Coen films to say, well, how is that typical for him? I would definitely say memorable, very well placed, either by them or by the Coens themselves. But yeah, I'd have to find out a little bit more about the way the Coens work.
And I think it sort of follows on from that, which I find quite interesting, is the fact that they have started not collaborating, in the sense that the Coen brothers now seem to be making individual films. So we've had The Tragedy of Macbeth from Joel Coen, and there's a film coming out, I think, later this year or maybe the beginning of next year from Ethan Coen, sort of individually. Yet both of them are still using Carter Burwell. So, you know, they've both got custody in the divorce, and they're both sort of he's scoring their film still. So I think it'll be interesting to see how the contrast the two different or future films going forward, if they continue to work individually but with the same composer, whether you can start to see a sort of difference in the way that's handled.
Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I mean, talking about collaborations, as you've said, Alan, it's the Coen brothers themselves are a collaboration, working on direction, writing, editing together. And we've not until now seen them working separately. So it will be interesting to see, you know, what did the individual Coen brothers, what did Joel bring to the table? What did Ethan bring to the table? How is that going to develop? I have to say that I feel sad that for the moment they're not working with each other anymore. And I think from everything that I've read, it's not quite clear what the issue is. What I've heard is that I think Ethan has said he's kind of a bit filmed out, but there is such an absence of anyone saying, okay, here's what happened, that obviously it's difficult not to start to, you know, to wonder, to listen to rumors and everything.
Exactly. I mean, I think I read that as well, that it was Ethan Coen had said, you know what, I'm slightly bored. I'm slightly, yeah, filmed out. And I think Joel Coen was like, well, that's why I'm making my own film and press ahead. But now, of course, there is an Ethan Coen film coming. So in terms of being filmed out, it obviously didn't last that long. So it'll be interesting how things play out with the films they've currently making. And I mean, I hope they work together again, or at least I hope, even if they don't, that they're still, you know, good brothers, good buddies and brothers.
Absolutely.
And also in terms of Frances McDormand and her career, how she's had a double Oscar win since for Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri and Nomadland. So she's also kind of moved outside the realm of the Coen brothers very much so, and has made very different career steps as well. So she also will have to be gotten back into the world of the Coens if they choose to collaborate again, maybe.
she's married to one of them, so I think a sort of collaboration with Joel Coen is probably... I mean, it was interesting just to mention on Blood Simple that the reason she's in the film is because of that relationship, and because that sort of meant that, you know, she was part of the gang making the film for no money. They didn't, you know, they didn't have to pay someone to come in. So I think it's sort of an interesting career that starting out in this low-budget film, helping out your partner, and then, you know, going on to this great career, and now still, when he's making a film, she's helping out her partner.
Absolutely. Okay, so I would say intervention successfully done.
Done.
And if we can also get a podcast out of this, I'm happy with it. This has been the third part of our Summer of Collaborations. I'm looking forward to the fourth part, which is forthcoming. That was not a pun, but it almost sounded like one. In the meantime, I would like to, as always, thank our listeners for joining us. I would like to thank both you, Sam, and Alan for a very fun conversation. I really enjoyed this. So yeah, we will be back soon with another damn fine cup of culture. And in the meantime, have a good summer and see you around. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.